is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builders Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon, and thanks for being here. We're doing another Wine and the Umpqua program. We've had a lot of stress, a lot of heavy topics in the news, and thought we'd take a little breather, especially on a Friday afternoon. Dyson DeMar from Hillcrest Vineyards, thanks for coming in.
Oh, always a great pleasure.
Well, so a lot of things going on, and it's been an interesting year for the wine industry in Oregon and really other places as well. What has it been like for you from sort of the COVID-19 impacts?
Well, before I get into that, Kyle, I just heard your weather report, and as you know, we make a little bit of wine in Europe and have worked over there over a few decades, and you said 50 degrees and raining for Oregon, and a dear friend of mine from the Mosel Valley in Germany where we produce wine always told me, hey, if somebody ever kidnaps you and blindfolds you, and you wake up and it's 50 degrees and raining, you're in Germany. So I'm going to pretend for right now I'm in the Mosel Valley, but anyway. 2020 has been really, we all know the bad jokes, and that has been a super, super interesting year. From a wine standpoint, the same thing. It was a tremendous roller coaster, really unmatched in my lifetime of any vintage. Where the rubber hits the road is, you know, vintage. What do those wines look like? And I'm super, super happy to say it's a short vintage. I mean, there are wineries that won't produce wine for reasons I'm sure we'll go into shortly. A lot of vineyards are down significantly. We saw around here some vineyards around here being in the Umpqua Valley, but this also pertains to up in the Willamette, yields sometimes being down 50, 60, 70% in tons per acre. But the quality is really spectacular. It was a super classic vintage. Grapevines, I always say, are like humans, that we like kind of nice, easy conditions, not too hot, not too cold. And at certain temperatures, mid-70s, and that is when you have ideal buildup of flavors. That's when the vine is most active in terms of evolving and developing flavors and colors and textures and that. This year, as we know, I mean, we really didn't have those heat spells per se. We really didn't have any dramatic weather, and it just coasted in a beautiful, beautiful way with a little bit of a scare at the end. But I really look forward to these wines being spectacular, those wines that hit the bottle.
It had to be very challenging, though, just to deal with all of that. I mean, anything in agriculture always has its ups and downs. You can do everything right, and the wrong weather hits at the wrong time versus what you wanted, and you've got to sort of pivot and adjust. And this year added a lot more complexities to that.
Yeah, it did, and you know, maybe it's one of the good things of being old. Once you've seen enough of that, you just kind of you're along for the ride, and you realize everybody else is in the same boat. So we definitely had those kind of rock and roll conditions, both in terms of the marketplace as well as what nature delivered. You know, there was projections of overproduction significantly, so a lot of people weren't renewing contracts. There's a lot of fruit that was not committed for. You know, partway into the season, we saw people jumping in when they realized they were going to have low yields because we had problems at flowering and from weather part of 19. So because that the weather the year before influences the potential quantity of fruit the following year, what are called fruit primordia. But and then later in the season when everybody, you know, when we got smoke taint, then you get into, you know, you've got the smoke, you don't know how it's affected your vineyards, your varieties, you know, a lot of fruit was walked away from. So it was all over the board. And so, you know, I think I'm going into almost my fourth decade in the wine business. And, you know, I used to, it's like a newborn. When I first got in the business, you know, you just sit there and look at it, wait for it to do something. And it takes, you know, about 6 months before that baby starts really smiling and rolling around and moving around. And that wine, same thing. I mean, you can get lost in this thing at points in a growing season, especially from an agricultural standpoint, that you think it's tragic, you know, rain at flowering and these kind of things. Mother Nature tends to always wrap that up. And fortunately with wine grapes, especially in the New World, we tend to have much more consistent weather conditions. So you don't have these catastrophic vintages. I've seen maybe one or two in my entire life. And once again, almost four decades of winemaking in that. But, you know, you learn that it's nature in control, and we kind of work with nature, and we have to figure out when to jump in and out. And the same thing is true in winemaking. In winemaking, you know, there are varieties that are neurotic, like Pinot Noir, that you taste it one day, maybe a month after you've fermented it, and you've got it in barrel, and it tastes spectacular, and you're thinking, oh, that is so beautiful. That's the best Pinot Noir ever made. somebody comes by, you know, wine rider or whatever, you taste from that same barrel like a week later, and you're like, oh my God, what happened? Something happened to that wine. And, you know, give yourself, you know, 12 months, 18, 24 months, and you really see what that's about. So it's much like, I always say wine is like many other things in life. There's a level of maturity. And once you step back a little bit, and it's like cooking a dinner, but you cook for 1, 2, 3, 4 years, however long you age your wines and that. But Mother Nature tends to do the right thing. And the real magic is knowing when to jump in and when not to, especially for great wines. Great wines is like great food ingredients that when you have a perfect piece of fish, it's kind of a sin to grill it and put teriyaki sauce on it. You know, that should be sashimi or something maybe very lightly sauteed or grilled, but let the ingredients speak. And, you know, as you and I have talked about many times before on air, is that, you know, that's part of the magic of Umpqua Valley, and it's part of what drove myself and my family out of Napa Valley is, I mean, looking for a place that consistently can produce fine wine, and Umpqua Valley is what where we planted our flag.
So what did you think going through this year? I mean, it's early to tell now, but was there a particular varietal that you were maybe happiest with?
Too early to tell. I kid you not. It takes about 6 months or a year for me to really feel good about, okay, this certain variety is walking down the path. There was maybe the greatest surprise, because I see a lot of quality across the board, but the greatest surprise is, as you know, we took over the old Misty Oaks just a little over a year ago, and we have done a lot of work in the vineyards and grafted over to some Italian varietals. So we're going to call that Pozzo Colina when that opens up, which means Crazy Hill, which is a play on Hillcrest, which is kind of our base camp. But we brought in Sangiovese this year that is really, really spectacular. And I've made a lot of different varieties. You know, there's somewhere between 4,000 and 8,000 grape varieties in the world, depending on who you talk to. And I've made, I figure, about 40 varieties into wine. First time I've done Sangiovese commercially, and it is like super beautiful. It's actually fairly dark. It's structured like you'd see some appellations within Tuscany. So if you get into an area called Brunello di Montalcino, which is the south end of greater Tuscany or Chianti or Tuscany in central Italy, you get a little bit more power and structure in those wines, but a super, super perfumey fruit, which you see in like the top sub-appellations of Chianti Classico, where you get this real strong like raspberry perfume that, you know, you swirl wine in a glass before you bring it up to your nose and you smell it. That perfume kind of jumps out at you. So I don't know if I've ever told you this, but how we ended up in Umpqua Valley was doing research. We sold a vineyard and a winery we had in Napa, and I was working for Mondavi, and I was doing climate research to find out what areas of the world were like Piemonte in northern Italy, where we love those wines. Our daughter went to school over in Italy, and she's worked in that region that produces Barolo and Barbaresco. And Umpqua Valley and Mendoza, Argentina were the two areas that kept coming up. And this is a NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, shares climate data with most governments in the world. So you can load in certain parameters and it'll rank the areas of the world that are like that. And so that's how we first came upon Roseburg. We actually went to Mendoza, Argentina. I'd worked there years ago and we kind of knew what that was about. That was kind of exciting. And then I remember looking at Roseburg and going like, where's Roseburg? I think I stopped for gas there once. And we came here and, you know, within about 2 or 3 hours of being on the ground and looking, I was like, well, this has the nature. And we ran across Hillcrest and this. But anyway, the Italian varietals here, from what I've tasted and the little bit that we've done, we do Teraldego now. We planted in 01 in Umpqua Valley, an Italian varietal, super spectacular. And I think there's an incredibly bright future for Italian varietals in Umpqua Valley.
Are Italian varietals, are they getting more popular?
Yeah, Italian varietals have actually always been very popular, usually the most popular. So the tug of war of what do we drink more of in terms of wines, we drink a lot of French and a lot of Italian. The French were always classified. French always had political and economic stability. So you had the church that would make fine wine to gain favor from the king. So those wines became very famous. In Italy, the wines were not as famous, even though they were every bit as good. The challenge is, you know, Italy wasn't formed until 1861 when it became a country. Before that, it was warring states. So like Florence would war with Siena and those areas, I don't know, 50, 60 miles apart. And so it was just hurry up and make some wine so we have something to drink on the battlefield, you know. And so now that they have political, or I shouldn't say that, but anyway, they have stability, we'll say, that they can produce fine wine. Italy has more varieties in the ground than any country that I know of in the world. So I mentioned earlier, 4,000 to 8,000 grape varieties. Italy has 2,800 documented varieties in the ground. And there's so many varieties that are grown in little pockets in central eastern Italy in the Adriatic in a valley that's like 4 miles wide and 10 miles long. La Crema d'Amore d'Alba is a variety I was thinking of when I said that. And so there are so many varieties, it's absolutely endless. And if you look at the climate, you have everything from very, very cool, like like in Trento near Bolzano, if you come out of Austria, many people have been there, that Alpine character where you get like Pinot Grigio and Schiava and different things, to where you have, you know, moderate areas maybe that are more in line with what we do in the southern part of northern Italy and central Italy, Sangiovese, Montepulciano, Barbera, those things, all the way to southern Italy. There's so many things we haven't explored here. And these varieties have been played with a little bit in the past. Richard Summers, father of Oregon wine that started Hillcrest and father of Pinot Noir in Oregon, one of the varieties he brought with him was a Barbera. And we've done Barbera for a number of years, and Barbera here is absolutely spectacular. And that's a variety. They say northern Italy lubricates its daily bread with Barbera. And you go to wineries that produce El Grande wine, $450, $1,500 a bottle from grapes called like Nebbiolo and Spana and this. And the thing is that they'll pour you these expensive wines, and you taste them, and you're like, oh, that's so beautiful. And you turn around, and the winemaker's sitting there pouring you himself a glass of like $40 Barbera. It's so absolutely delicious. So we really, in Oregon, have yet to write a book on those varieties and many other varieties. Eastern Europe, same.
All right, going to take a break on Inside Douglas County. Dyson DeMar from Hillcrest Vineyards. More when we come back. The interview podcast after 1 at 541radio.com, 1247 at News Radio 1240, KQEN. County 1249, Lars Larson program coming up at 1 o'clock. More on the announcements made in this past hour by Governor Kate Brown. You'll hear about that. We'll have a follow-up this afternoon as well. Looks like the president set to announce something related to the vaccine situation as well coming up next hour. We'll have all of that for you. Dyson Noir from Hillcrest Vineyards, a wine in the Emploi program. And let's back up sort of a step as you've been here for a number of years. Talk about how much winemaking in the Umpqua Valley has changed in terms of having so many more acres planted with grapes.
Yeah, when we took over Hillcrest, and Hillcrest is the oldest wine grape winery in Oregon, having started post-Prohibition 1961, there were 7 wineries. We took over and came out of Napa in 2003. Today, I think we're up to 30-plus winery tasting rooms and that. And the landscape has changed a lot. That's tremendous growth off of a very, very small base. We've seen a more experience, which is a great thing, come out of other areas. I mean, it takes a long time, even if you have experience other places, to really understand what's on the ground in a new area. But I think the thing that's changed the most, and this is visible to everyone, is the landscape where you have, you know, very large vineyards. When we first came here, you had a lot of vineyards either owned by wineries or owned by growers of fruit that would sell the fruit. There were 10, 15, 20 acres. We still have those, but you've really seen the large plantings that we have, especially out in the Melrose, Garden Valley area. You get farther out towards Umpqua. And so a lot of people are surprised by this, but about 3/4 of the fruit, which is almost all Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris that are grown in Umpqua Valley, leave this valley. So this is an area, and this is common many places in the world. If you go to Bordeaux, France, every once in a while a winery gets busted for bumping their wines with, maybe in the back they find a tanker car of a Tuscan wine, Sangiovese, and they blend that in a light vintage. You go to Burgundy in the old days, they'd go down into the Rhone Valley that grows Syrah, and they'd bring in a barrel or two to kind of pump their wines up. And that. So the wines that are grown here that end up typically in the north, a little bit down in the south as well, those wines are used to give you ripeness, to give you richness, and for other reasons as well. So that landscape has really changed. We still have, they say in Oregon there's over 1 million plantable acres, and I think we're somewhere around 50,000 acres planted, and that would include all Appalachians from, you know, east of the Cascades, Walla Walla portion that is in the state of Oregon, Willamette Valley, Umpqua, in the Rogue Valley in the south. So we're still, I always say, day one. I mean, this is the beginning, and things are going to change so much in the next generation. But we have so far to go before we really understand Umpqua Valley in terms of, you know, we have the big picture, but it's really kind of drilling sites, like what site is best for what variety, how do you plant it, what rootstock, what spacing. That takes a long time, and actually that's brilliant, because the thing is, the fun is getting there. If you talk to areas that have had an understanding of what they grow and how they grow it for 2,000 years, usually end up with something called Appellation Control-E, where the government comes in and regulates what rootstock you can plant, how far apart the plants have to be, what three or four varieties you can grow, when you have to pick them, on and on and on. And so in the modern world, where we like to explore, and that we rely on the free market, here we get to explore. And I mean, I firmly believe that the variety maybe Umpqua Valley is best known for in 100 years hasn't even been put in the ground yet. So there, if you believe there are 8,000 grape varieties in the world, we are at 80 planted now that we know of in Umpqua Valley. So that's 1%.
All those regulations you talked about, I know a couple of years ago, Earl Jones at Abicella was talking about that. And I had never heard that before. That was brand new information to me. And I thought, well, you know, here you plant something, and every once in a while I hear about somebody planting a certain varietal, and it's like, with my really limited knowledge, it's like, I don't think that's the best place for that. But it's like, okay, that's your decision. It's your money. It's your rear. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Or if it's mediocre, it's mediocre. But to have all of that, no, you can't even try, because a number of winemakers here, grape growers, have tried things that people said, oh, you can't do that, but it worked because they had looked at the science.
Exactly. We would not have wine grape growing in Oregon. UC Davis was teaching when Richard Summers went there that Oregon was too cold and too wet to grow fine wine grapes. I love sayings. Those of you that are out there know, you come in the taste room and catch up with me, I'll throw three or four sayings at you. My favorite saying of all time is Thomas Jefferson saying that the greatest defect of the human mind is making things so because you wish them to be. And so that is one of it's a human condition that we go in and we think we know and we limit ourselves. We really don't take a look at things. There are so many varieties. I've heard people say, if we all grew this one grape variety in Umpqua Valley, we'd be famous. You know, greatest defect of the human mind is making things so because you wish them to be. And so the idea is you open it wide up and you look at everything. And sometimes you don't, you know, some of the great varieties, the first, you know, generation, okay, it took them a while to figure out how do you prune it or what rootstock do you plant it on. It can make beautiful, beautiful wine. And that's kind of that, that's the beauty of wine, is matching your thoughts and human experience and the power of nature and the different nature in an area. And then the human element of like, when you pick and how do you treat that wine inside, that all those variables known and many variables unknown come to some kind of an equilibrium that gives you something that sends a shiver up your spine.
Well, and I have been at tasting rooms where sometimes folks are from out of the area and you just end up chatting, or at least back when people talk to each other before March and all of the distancing regulations. But folks that would come down from Salem, Portland, things like that, because they said, well, up there, everywhere we go, it's Pinot Noir, and we like Pinot Noir, but we would like some other things too.
Yeah. Yeah, so that diversity we have here, we have a diversity of climate from extreme maritime. You get up near west of Henry's, west of Sutherland, where we've all seen it, Henry Goes Wine, that howling wind come in off the ocean through the canyon, to you get down south into Looking Glass Valley. It's, you know, starts tending towards more continental. You look at that kind of those muted oak, small trees, the greens are not real, real green like you'd see maybe Western Melrose. All those things, different smells and flavors. Range of temperatures. We have huge range of temperature from, you know, the cooler parts of Elkton or high elevation central part of Umpqua Valley west of Roseburg to very warm areas in the south, or maybe even, you know, west of Oakland. So we're like Henry's Winery is west of Sutherland, and that's a very cool area because that wind moving through. But if you look to the north from like Lighthouse Bakery to the east, you'll see that there's some mountains that run like north-south, and you get on the east side of that up off the valley floor a little bit, and you get in some of the hottest places in Douglas County that you can do a range of varieties. So it's the beauty is the exploration. Also, from an economic standpoint, it's very powerful. So you go to the Mosel Valley of Germany, you're going to drink Riesling 20 ways at one winery. You're going to go to Burgundy, you're going to taste typically Pinot Noir 20 ways at one winery. You go down the road, somebody does Chardonnay 5 different ways, kind of. Okay, there's always somebody in the group that doesn't like this, doesn't like that. The ability to pour through, and I say we are the Russian River in terms of landscape, you know, from conifers and high ridges to the west to sandstone fingers that fall down into the valley floor to oak savanna in the eastern side of Sonoma County, Dry Creek that looks like Garden Valley area. We have, we can grow almost everything. We can grow early season varieties for sure, which are like Pinot Noir and that, Sauvignon Blanc, mid-season, Syrah, Merlot, Malbec, and then we get into like, you know, Tannat, Cabernet Sauvignon, Petite Syrah in the warmer climate varieties. So once again, a lot of those things haven't been tried, and then I can name, sitting right here, a bunch of varieties that nobody's ever tried that are interesting, and in time, those people will stick something in the ground, and you don't know until you put it in the ground.
Dyson Nebar of Hillcrest Vineyards, thanks for coming in.
Always a great, great pleasure, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone.
You've been listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN, a daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications, your home for Douglas County's news team. News Radio 1240 KQEN.